Bill McRaven, retired admiral, Navy SEAL, 37 years, former head of U.S. Special Operations.
Hillary Clinton fan.
Special Operations.
Excuse me, Hillary Clinton fan.
Who led the operations, commanded the operations that took down Saddam Hussein and that killed Osama bin Laden, says that your sentiment is the greatest threat to democracy in his lifetime.
Okay, he's a Hillary Clinton backer and an Obama backer. And frankly,
he was a Navy SEAL.
Wouldn't it have been nice if we got Osama bin Laden a lot sooner than that?
let's keep laughing on the recording. That was Chris Wallace of Fox News jousting with President Donald Trump in an interview that ran over the weekend. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to your favorite laugh track weekly roundtable conversation among editors of a libertarian magazine. Was that Suderman? You feel like you didn't have your laugh in there? It's the Reason Podcast. I'm Matt Welch, joined as per usual by my my frenemies, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mengu Ward. Good morning, gigglers.
Yeah.
Good morning.
The podcast is always a bucket of laughs.
A bucket of laughs?
A basket of deplorables? A bucket is the least appealing packaging for laughter.
It's like it's like one of those rolling mop buckets that you have to use when to like clean a grocery store or something. I did this when I worked at Winn-Dixie in Florida.
God.
And I'm just imagining it.
Look at you.
Right, laughs.
Look at you. You're the common man.
Job reference. Right. We're not even a full 2 minutes into the podcast, and Peter's like, let me tell you about a weird job I had in Florida.
Well, as Nick and I wrote in the Declaration of Independence, no, just kidding.
How libertarian politics can fix what's
wrong
with
I actually will
America.
Tell you my what are you consuming later is going to be something from the print magazine, so all we're right. Good to go here, yeah. Guys.
So let's talk. Wow, that was loud. That resonated.
Before we stop about the laughter, one of the things I was laughing that clip later, Trump goes on to a whole thing like, and this is where, you know, it's like if talking to most presidents is talking to a water fountain, he's like a bidet. He just keeps spraying upward in modulated speeds and stuff, and he goes on a jaunt about how, like, you know, they knew all along that Osama bin Laden was living openly in Pakistan next to the military academy in a mansion, or what seems to be a mansion in Pakistan. You know, I've seen better mansions. And, like, suddenly you're like, what? Like, you know, am I validating your parking? Like, what is this conversation about?
At the end, you feel kind of fresh and clean, you know, down in your private
mansion. Yes, pretty much, you know? Yeah. You know, you feel like you've been transformed in some subtle but significant way. Somebody called him an idiot savant of, you know, just kind of a bullshit. And he really is. You got to give him to it.
Catherine, rescue us, if you can. From this
I'm not
French
sure.
Toilet that we've started out with here. You had a piece in this Sunday's New York Times, which had my wife giggling out loud at the George Clooney line. It was titled Trump and Acosta When Showboats Collide. So let's refract on this 40-second clip that started this podcast with the giggling and look at kind of that angle of it. And I should point out, there's important news this morning that the White House is once again threatening to revoke CNN's reporter Jim Acosta's press pass at the end of the month. This is occasioning new court battles. And very importantly, Iowa hawk Dave Burge, one of the better follows on the internet, in response, has tweeted out, "My dearest Sarah, in the smoky dusk of the evening past, our exhausted surviving regiment celebrated the recapture of Acosta Pass. With a new dawn, it appears General Trump's forces are rallying for counterattack, and I fear there will be no end to this bloodshed. Pray for me." So, Catherine, my two-part...
It was all worth it. The Trump administration, government, the
worth
whole thing.
It for that tweet?
Yep.
Yeah. Actually, that's a great meme. The, like, the Civil War soldier letter meme is really one of the internet's better products. Right. So, the idea of this piece was to try to capture the way in which Donald Trump and the press generally, but especially the White House press corps, are locked in this kind of self-reinforcing cycle. I actually, to write this piece, spent a little bit of time on Wikipedia trying to sort out the difference between like parasitism and symbiosis, because I realized I wasn't exactly sure, like, can you be mutually parasitic? Because symbiosis in theory means that it's working for both entities and they will like live and thrive, whereas this is not working. Like, this dynamic is not working for both entities.
Nick can tell you codependency, right?
Right. So it's codependency, as Nick well knows. And it's.
I want to point out, by the way, that Matt and I collaborated, and that Matt is like the most willing collaborator since Coco Chanel.
So this is the.
So Trump doesn't drink alcohol. Instead, he just like argues with Jim Acosta.
Yeah. No. Exactly. That basically, like, right now, it looks like it's working for both sides. But I think eventually it will result in the collapse of the hollowed out husks of both.
Isn't the host the United States though? I mean, they're both parasites. It's like two pilot fish nibbling at different ends of the shark or something.
No, but the pilot fish helped the shark. This is what I'm telling you, man. So I'm like an expert on symbiosis now.
Are they like lampreys? Lampreys, they kill the fish, right?
Okay, yeah. So is this like a Venom Eddie Brock type situation?
I don't know what that means. So what I'm saying here is Jim Acosta had his press pass revoked. It was restored with a temporary injunction on due process grounds, essentially. And which caused the Trump administration to immediately be like, oh, you want some due process? Okay, here's a warning. We're taking your press pass away in a month. Process. And they're going to take it away again. So, like, there's going to be a big, long, ugly lawsuit. And it's going to be great for everyone because Trump can use the lawsuit to show how the press is against him, which, by the way, it is by and large. And CNN can use the lawsuit to show how the president is against the press, which, by the way, he is by and large. And the whole thing will generate infinite chyrons unto the distance. And in the end, even if Jim Acosta never sets foot on White House grounds again, his career will thrive. Donald Trump will probably thrive. Our institutions will crumble into dust.
Has anybody asked Betsy DeVos whether this is appropriate due process?
I'm pretty sure if I've read the Title IX coverage correctly, then Betsy DeVos's goal is for every woman who has ever been raped to have to directly face her accuser and let him spit in her face. Directly face her rapist. And then he gets to spit in her face. And that's how due process works now. I'm correctly reading the coverage.
Trump Acosta interview is going
to
be like?
Yes.
To go back to the starting point of this conversation, McRaven says that the president's hostility to the press is the biggest security threat or existential threat facing America. We should focus on that and say that is such utter and total horseshit. And even the president kicking out CNN would not be that threat. And I think,
I do say that in the piece, I think that that is a really important point to say. Listen, Jim Acosta's showboaty questions are not the bulwark between us and tyranny. And when CNN pretends that they are, they're playing into Trump's hands and vice versa. So, yes, it's true. They could never have a White House press briefing again. And that would not be a major dent out of freedom of the press. That's important to note. At the same time, there are rituals. They are typically observed. They are often observed for good reasons. And blowing up that system will have second order effects.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. But then what, for me, like looking over the past week's news, you had a couple of things, including, you know, this renewed interest in McRaven's comments about what is or isn't the biggest threat. When you have military men saying, you know, the real problem is the president is going after the free press, in the same week that the New York Times reported aides, and again, unnamed sources, so we can take it for what it's worth or not, the reason why Trump hasn't visited troops in any active combat zones is because he does not believe we should be there. I'm not a deep state person. I think there is a military industrial complex which has its own logic and its own rules. I don't think there's any kind of real cabal of stuff. But we are continuing to see again and again in the Trump years, he has clear disdain or ignorance of what the military does, you know, in general, it seems, and certainly the intelligence community. He is really fighting a battle against these people who are constantly, like, the number of people from the intelligence community and from the military, retired and, you know, active while anonymous, saying that he is undermining, you know, the bulwark of democracy, which means always, like, something about military spending, something about intelligence spending. He's openly criticizing these people. And I think that's a conversation that's worth kind of flushing to the top of, you know, of visibility to talk about. Because it seems to me a lot of people now are attacking the press somehow, or Trump and new media, because last week the New York Times and the Washington Post came out with stories about how social media is turning us all into a bunch of idiots who fall for scam stories, and hence Trump. There's a lot of negativity about the media, as, and it's being defined by, on the one hand, generals, and on the other, you know, failing legacy media.
Nick, but wouldn't the following cut against at least some of the idea that Trump is fighting anything like a concerted campaign against military, which is that he just gave them the biggest largesse that they've had in a while, A, and then B, also, and this goes to stuff with the Veterans Administration that we were talking about last week, I think, if I remember through the goofball pill combo that I'm currently quaffing down every day, that, you know, he signed in, or he pushed through in 2017, the new GI Bill Act, which has not been very well implemented because of tech reasons. Who knew that the government's not good at IT? But he's been throwing money at the problem for sure. But he has, it would seem he also has kind of a cultural issue as much as a policy issue with them. Like he is not doing the rituals. And I'll throw this to Peter, since he hasn't talked nearly enough about his Florida past. But the stunt down at the border with 19 miles of razor wire with the military can't help either, Peter, right?
No, it doesn't help. It's expensive. And there were reports in major media, basically sort of senior military officials complaining, I think legitimately, that it's bad for morale and missions that no one believes in, that are endless, that cause troops to be deployed and miss, be away from their families during the holidays for stupid reasons, for entirely political reasons, are terrible. They're terrible for the military. They're terrible for military effectiveness and readiness. They're expensive for taxpayers. They're good for one thing, if and at most, and that is glorifying, you know, helping Trump and Republicans in the midterms. And that it was entirely a stunt. And I think it's, you know, I think you can say on the one hand that Trump is less interested in foreign adventurism than previous presidents, and sort of less simpatico with the kind of military, the general thinking within the military, and perhaps even in some ways that are useful. I don't know if I quite want to say good, but that are useful. On the other hand, he's not really making the case. In fact, he campaigned heavily on increasing military spending, has signed budgets, supported budgets that increase military spending. He's giving these guys more money. What he doesn't like is helping allies. Like that's the thing that he's not interested in, and what he wants them to do. He basically wants to treat them like clients of the United States, wants them to pay in, views them as revenue producing outlets, basically like a real estate developer or a landlord. And he's not making a concerted public case by refusing to go and visit troops who are already deployed. He's not making an argument about America's place in the world and what we should be doing. And he's certainly not doing anything to reduce funding and reduce spending and change the way that that America conducts itself and its foreign policy.
I should say also that Brian Doherty had a piece last week saying that we dropped more bombs on Afghanistan, I believe, in last year than we had in any other year there. Trump, when he was still president-elect, I think, gave an interview to the Times of London, basically reiterating what he had often pondered on the campaign trail, which is, what the hell are we doing in Afghanistan? And unsatisfyingly, his first decision related to that was basically stay the course, or, you know, add another 1,000 or a couple thousand troops there. He hasn't acted on that impulse yet. We'll see what happens in the rest of his presidency. But before we leave the media part, Catherine, It's easy to say that McRaven is full of wet beans when it comes to...
Yuck. It was hard for me to hear that, though.
Yeah, I know.
By the way, congratulations on sustaining a metaphor throughout an entire length of an op-ed.
That was very impressive. A real, like, linguistic gem to read, treat to read.
So it's not the the first threat. Trump's attacks on the media, his sort of like a careless enemy of the people type of language, and his behavior so far in office. Is it top five? Is it top 10? Is it a thing worth worrying about, criticizing, wondering about?
Our scarce resource is worrying about things the president does. Like, you could worry about every single thing every single day. I am generally of the opinion that the only reason to particularly worry about the fate of the press under Trump is because it's so effective as a rallying point for both sides. Right. It's so, so powerful. People love to get really, really angry about it. And I think as we go into an election season, which we are, because election seasons are now 2 years, that there's going to be a lot of incentives to really ramp it up. And I actually mentioned in passing in the New York Times piece something which I fully ripped off from David Baidoo and an excellent, excellent piece that he wrote for Reason Magazine a while back. About FDR and how just incredibly abusive FDR was to the press under his presidency. He said 85% of the newspapers were against him. He accused papers of being edited from the counting room, meaning for financial concerns only, with respect to their editorial positions on the New Deal. He used the FCC to crack down on broadcast licenses. We've talked about this before on this podcast. By the end of his administration, he wanted to change libel laws so that knowingly publishing anything that was untrue, not even knowingly, just publishing anything that was untrue would be punishable by a couple of years in jail. Like, this dude was serious about not tolerating press opposition. And, I think it's always good to keep in mind how far these things can go. And Trump has alluded lightly in a non-serious way, I think mostly, to pursuing some of those angles, especially the license revocation stuff. We are safer now. The press is more robust. Even if he revoked every broadcast license, there would still be all kinds of ways to get information out there that didn't exist under FDR. So I am sanguine in general about the future of communications and the freedom of the press. It doesn't mean Trump can't make a huge issue out of this, and we could all be obsessed with this when there's other stuff to talk about, like, for instance, the budget for defense.
This is what he doesn't want to. This is some of the stuff that he doesn't want to talk about. And I agree, Matt, when you know, Trump is simultaneously bashing the brass. He's going after the Pentagon and the intelligence community while shoveling more money at them and by extension at to soldiers. He's not a systematic thinker. He's, you know, and I would say he's incoherent, but I don't mean that in a pejorative way. It's just that there is no system to what he does, really. He just does what he does.
I think we should be pejorative about that. I'm cool with pejorative on that.
I'm just saying it's purely descriptive of, you know, his left hand doesn't know what his right hand is doing.
His right hand is like, here's a 2.6% pay increase. $716 billion defense budget.
But this is what, for me, when we talk about kind of freedom of the press or freedom of expression, which is more important, because who fucking cares about the press, right? I mean, it's whether or not are more people and more organizations going to be able to get their messages out as they see them and everything. I think we're in good shape. The biggest problem is not from Trump himself, because there is the Constitution, but it is Congress. Congress is the one that grilled Facebook and Google and Twitter and is putting the screws to them because Diamond and Silk don't get enough views and, the Russians threw the election against Hillary. They're the ones who are actually pushing stuff, Facebook and Google and Twitter are also trying to come up with ways to maintain their business models, which are starting to go into the tank because people are, for all sorts of reasons, getting annoyed or pissed off. And then you have older companies like, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post that have their own business interests that are trying to change things. And you have groups like the ACLU, which is like, you know what, free speech isn't that important anymore. What we're going to do is pick and choose certain types of free expression battles. It's the reaction to Trump that is the biggest problem, because I think those are the legislative as well as cultural movers who can really shrink or make shrink the sphere of public debate and discourse, or make it a lot harder to have serious good faith conversations, because we know what Trump is.
Peter, to Nick's point about social media in particular, is there I know you were you know, the biggest kind of critic of what social media does to our brain tubes here on the podcast, but is there something to Nick's point that the anti-Trump, the reaction to Trump, is in part a reaction against social media, which has been seen to have enabled Trump-like stuff? So is that where a concentrated threat to free expression might come?
Well, I think there's two fronts here. One, Congress is investigating and taking a kind of increasingly aggressive stance against social media, because both Republicans and Democrats have partisan political reasons, ideological reasons to view social media basically as the new monopolists and the new kind of big corporate targets that need to be regulated and taken down. Trump isn't, for the most part, himself waging a war on social media. His battle is with very old school traditional media, with CNN, with The Washington Post, where, full disclosure, my wife works, with The New York Times, with major media outlets and the way they are covering him. And I think that what Trump has done is basically take a page from the old sort of political playbook that says that when you are in trouble, when you are struggling politically, what should you do as a politician, especially as a president? You should start a war. And in the, during the campaign, there were people who I think even reasonably worried that if Trump's approval numbers fell, what would he do to keep people interested, entertained, and supporting him? He might go and start a war. Well, Trump did, except that war was with CNN and The Washington Post and The New York Times. And that is the enemy that he has chosen to rally his fans against. Rally his supporters against. And frankly, I think while I think it is in many ways quite destructive for the polity and like bad for our politics, I would much rather have our president fighting Jim Acosta than dropping bombs on people elsewhere in the world.
Retreated from your instinct there to start naming a random foreigner that you could draw a bomb on, which could have been a really good opportunity for the future of your career at Vox.
Which Trump, you know, I mean, Trump like might just wake up. It's still possible that he will just wake up one day and be like, need a war somewhere.
Well,
and like kind of throw a dart.
You know, this is one of the things that's frustrating, though, is that we are at war. And we, so in a way, Trump is having his cake and eating it,
right,
too. Well, you know, nobody really knows about the Yemen war and our support of that, you know, unless you're kind of really follow the news. So he could reveal that and be like, here's something I've been working on this in the White House garage for months, and I'm ready to bring it out now.
But remember the first time that Trump launched airstrikes and the incredible wave of positive coverage.
Now,
it only lasted maybe 36 hours.
That was,
but that was the day that Trump became president.
Yeah.
And suddenly we all rallied behind him. And so that sort of thing is what makes me worry that he will actually start a real war, because Trump is totally incentive driven. He likes it when people like him and praise him. And he does stuff that is designed to get people to do that.
I want to go back to right after Trump was elected, but before he took office, I did a bunch of podcasts with people to take the temperature, or interviews of, you know, what do they think about Trump on this or that and on foreign policy. I talked to Thaddeus Russell, you know, who has Renegade University, has his own podcast called Unregistered. It's always worth listening to. And he said that on foreign policy, he preferred, a Trump victory to a Hillary victory because he thought in the short term Trump would be more erratic and volatile and probably drop more bombs than Hillary. But he lacks an overall synthetic view of foreign policy and the projection of American power. And I think that's being borne out, you know, pretty clearly that Trump, I'm not worried about Trump starting a major war. He seems to be against it. And that New York Times story, again, it's unsourced, you know, private aides, but he does not seem to really believe in any of the wars that America is currently involved in. Now, you would want a president who would then move from that position to say, I'm going to bring the boys home, especially if I actually care about veterans the way he says he does, even, you know, even when he runs veterans nonprofits and then stiffs them, you know, with giving them the money that's been raised and all of that. But I think we're he is legitimately uninterested in being a warrior president. And that
I
is
think that's right,
part
I think
of the reason why the people
it as, a, as unprofitable activity.
Yeah, but I don't care. You know, on a certain level, I don't care why. I mean, you know, Conrad Hilton in the 50s, I guess, he opened the first Western hotel in Moscow, and he was a super anti-communist, and he took a huge amount of shit from not just the John Birch Society, but from conservatives all over, saying like you're abetting communism by making it easier for people to live there. And he was like, you're idiots. Like, what I'm doing, this is the ultimate, you know, sneaking into the country in plain sight. It's a Trojan horse. And to a
Did
certain
he put
degree,
Bibles in the drawers?
Yeah, or Zsa Zsa Gabor's memoir or something. But it's, no, you know, I mean, I think if he thinks it's not profitable, good. I don't really care, but it's like less war is better. And, you know, now we get to one more conundrum, right, with Trump, which is that so it's not profitable. And now he's pursuing, you know, trade policies that are equally unprofitable. So there's a million different things to get pissed at him about and to fight him on. But it seems to me the thing about when the military and the intelligence community in particular come out, they're fighting a different set of, you know, they have a very comfortable understanding, and there was a consensus, at least since World War II, that this is what America is going to be. This is what our foreign policy, this is what our intelligence is going to be. And they get pissed when they start to see that they might be running out of roadway with that consensus. And I think Trump represents that.
I certainly think that it's preferable to a sort of more coherent hawkishness that starts a lot of new wars or expands the ones that we're in. But as a kind of an anti-war stance, a lot more military funding, dumb stunts at the border, and a complete inability to make a coherent and popular case against the traditional Beltway hawk way of thinking about America's position in the world and the way we use our military is certainly not ideal.
I agree. And you know, the fact that we also know that, we're in a world where we're still dealing with Russia and China in effectively Cold War terms. And the Cold War has been over for, you know, a quarter of a century. We
yeah,
need
for
a
you,
new...
maybe, Nick.
Yeah, that's true.
Some of us, it never dies. I mean, the...
it's over. It's over, Johnny.
No, it's not. I think there is some identifiable coherence to Trump's worldview. How much of it has been applied is a kind of a separate question. But in that he's anti-globalist, he does not like global supranational institutions. He doesn't have respect for them. He thinks that the European Union was hatched as a plot against the United States, as opposed to the European trading community being pretty much the United States idea as a way to be a bulwark against communism and a way for the Western Europe to rebuild after World War II. With that, he does, yes, throw out some of the notion that America should be the tip of the spear all over the globe. He's been pretty specific in his speeches in Saudi Arabia, in Poland, and in elsewhere, that you people should kind of deal with your own affairs and also pony up more for whatever collective defense organizations that we're in, which, by the way, I don't really like very much, kind of thing. But also as part of that, he rejects the post-World War II kind of trade consensus, which I think is a really bad thing. And he does it partially on sovereignty grounds, which is more defensible, and partly on really stupid mercantilist grounds, which is not defensible. But he also, and this hasn't really come to fruition yet, but several times, he has said, and his underlings have said, that America is going to take a more robust role in its own hemisphere, particularly in Cuba and Venezuela. There have been occasional honks of hawkishness here. And I would also end my soliloquy here by pointing out, with all that kind of, I think, sort of Bannonist, nationalist approach, anti, you know, Davos man type of approach. Right now, his foreign policy team doesn't really contain humans who share his own worldview. I mean, that's not John Bolton's worldview, except for the kind of cranky, don't like the UN aspect of it. It's not Mike Pompeo's worldview. So that'll be interesting to see in the next couple of years. Catherine, one last little thing on the media before we make a hard pivot here. The beginning of that clip that we played, Trump's going 94%, 94%, which I'm sure is a not exactly a verified number indicating negativity towards the president. But let's pretend for a second that that's true. Kind of feels true. Isn't the problem more less that it's 94% negative and more that it ain't 94% negative all the goddamn time, including towards Barack Obama?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is something we've talked about on this podcast before, but I am generally on the side of people shouldn't think their institutions are staffed by superheroes. They shouldn't think that there are people there who are more likable than like the average jerk who screwed up their Starbucks order this morning, because it's the same people. They're just humans and they suck. And I think that's something that's really worth keeping in mind, because there has been a historic tendency to consider both the president and the figureheads of the press, right? Like the Jim Acostas of the 1950s were godlike figures. And that's not healthy, because the Jim Acostas of the 1950s were also a bunch of jerks who had their own motivations and drives. And I think there's really, you know, if you look at these Gallup polls, we've talked about these many times, like the astonishing decline in confidence in every institution it's consistent. It's dramatic from the period in which they introduced C-SPAN cameras in Congress, which was 1979 through or 1976 through today. 46% of people now say they have very little trust in Congress, which is twice as much as the 23% back in the late 70s. This same decline is shown all over the place. And I don't think that's necessarily bad. I think, you know, Nick's point about declining trust in institutions perhaps leading to calls for more activist institutions is a real one, and it's a problem. But overall, I just don't want people going around thinking the president and Congress and CNN are filled with people who are better than us, because they're not.
Yeah, I agree with you, Catherine. And, the real question for the people in those institutions is to how do they change that perception? And this is the frustrating thing for me, is when people are like, oh, well, you know, we are no longer a trusting country. It's like, why should we be?
The children are trusting. Years. Adults are cynical and suspicious. We should not be children.
And then you build other new institutions or new ways of doing things that inspire trust. I was just reading an article early on about Uber in the early days of Uber and Lyft, and the arguments against, like, how, you know, why would anybody ever go into an Uber? Because, like, you would never get into a stranger's car that you have, you know, you have no idea who they are, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, that obviously was wrong, because Uber created a system of trust, which is so far superior to anything that's out there. Yeah.
It's literally trust but verify. And right now, the institutions of the state do not give us good tools to verify. They are always cutting back on those tools, like FOIA. It was constantly under assault, was under Obama, is under Trump. The idea of being able to trust people because you can see their guts, because you can see their ratings, because you can see what goes in and what comes out, is a very different prospect than what government asks us to do.
Maybe.
Unfortunately, no one ever seems to come to the conclusion these are limited institutions staffed by fallible beings. Let's reduce their power over our lives. Like, why? Why don't people ever get there, you guys?
I think the turning point of the first turn to the true 21st century, where we've just shaken off a lot of this old flaky skin, We've dermabrased and we're ready for the new century, is when Domino's Pizza admitted in a national ad campaign that,
their pizza was bad.
We sucked for like 25 years and we're going to do better. We're going to try better. That maybe we'll look back and that is the moment when, you know, the sun started rising again.
A little factlet before we leave the topic, finally, after many threats too, is that a lot of journalists in this time especially, as kind of a founding ethos of where they are in the modern world, look fondly back to the Richard Nixon era, the publishing the Pentagon Papers, lionized in the movie The Post, the Watergate, All the President's Men, and all this kind of stuff. And for very good reasons, it was a great anti-authoritarian moment culturally, and there was some good work done in newspapers. If you go back and look at what newspapers actually editorialized endorsement-wise in the 1972 election, during which Watergate was a known thing, the stuff was happening already in the fall of 72, the endorsement count was 753-56 for Nixon over George McGovern, which is almost as, even more lopsided or about equally to the 2016 endorsement count against Donald Trump, which is 244-20.
Can I say how much I love your like ferocious and ongoing rage at the shittiness of newspaper endorsements for president? Like, it's, I just love that, like, you're like, I am keeping score. Like, I am watching you, jerks.
I'm the one person doing it. I would recommend even better going back to my series of about newspaper editorial page rejections of California's Proposition 19 in 2010, because the only newspaper of any size that editorialized in favor of legalizing recreational marijuana in 2010 was the Santa Barbara News Press, which is owned by a hated local owner named Wendy McCaw. All of them were like filled with what are they smoking and that kind of stuff. And I wrote probably 17 blog posts at Hit and Run about the newspaper editorial endorsements.
That was epic because they couldn't not go with the shitty "Are you high?" punch, you know, headline, right? That was always.
I mean, let those of us who are without sin cast the first stone, Nick. I mean, careful there.
That might be true. All right, let's talk about an issue on which the president could be getting more credit if only it would happen. This is the first step. Act, which is a more significant act of criminal justice reform than many people thought was possible under an administration that came to power, you know, promising law and order and having troglodytes like Jeff Sessions as Attorney General until a couple
That's
of weeks
really
back.
Really kind of mean to cave dwellers, Matt.
It's true. Keebler elves. I never really understood what that means, but it seems funny. It's the First Step Act. The president, I think last week, was touting this as something that he was interested in signing. It would end the stacking of firearm penalties just to add to people's sentences. There involved sentencing reform, three strikes stuff, seemed to be coming perilously close to being passed. And then we hear whispers that Mitch McConnell isn't going to bring it to the floor during the lame duck session.
I think lame dick session is obviously the new term.
It was deck. I said deck. Suderman, is there any hope in this divided world of ours, this mixed up, shook up Tom Cotton world of ours, that this pretty obviously good thing can happen?
I would say there's some hope, but not enough. And the reason there's not enough is Mitch McConnell. And Mitch McConnell is a real obstacle to getting this passed. The scuttle is that behind the scenes, he initially was saying, I'm not going to bring this to the floor unless there's 60 votes. And then he said, I'm not going to bring this to the floor unless there's 65 votes. The sort of further rumor, and I should say that this is unconfirmed, but I think it's probably true, is that he is privately and behind the scenes encouraging Tom Cotton, who is probably the most the biggest Republican in opposition to criminal justice reform in the Senate. He's encouraging Tom Cotton to whip up opposition to this bill. And so now there's a report that McConnell's just saying, well, we're not really going to have time for this. I don't know if we're going to get there. I do think that President Trump's endorsement here matters a lot. And President Trump, when he gets behind something, can actually move the Republican Party. He's certainly done it on immigration. He has basically united the Republican Party against immigration reform, against kind of productive immigration proposals. But on this one, the party has been split as well. And I think he could potentially unite the party behind criminal justice reform. Certainly, we've seen a lot of state level efforts. And particularly in places like Texas, where Republicans have led the way. And this is an issue that a lot of sort of right-leaning, free market, Republican allied, and I use those not as as a single descriptor, but as sort of a bunch of different types of descriptors. Those sorts of groups have really backed this legislation, this type of legislation in states. They typically back it at the federal level as well. I think it has a real chance, maybe not immediately, but in the near future, because it's something that that Republicans will be able to will want to do, and we'll see that the president is leading on this. Now, I will also say President Trump's leadership is the kind of leadership that we tend to get from President Trump, which is not very clueful, not very coherent. He doesn't seem to entirely understand the particulars of the legislation. And if you look back at the Obamacare repeal fight from last year, that was a problem for getting the legislation over the line. You have a president who can't sell it, who can't explain it, who can't make the case at length. And that does present some barriers. However, Trump supporting it, the Republican Party tends to go where he goes. McConnell's opposition is real and a problem, but I think it could be overcome.
Catherine, I saw a headline last week in Breitbart.com, so it must be true, saying that it's a Koch Soros plot to sneak in this criminal-friendly legislation under the nose of an otherwise distracted Trump. How right are they?
I assume they're 100% right.
I mean, a plot? Though, right? It's not a like.
I mean,
plot
like
makes
they
it
didn't
sound like they're
meet
like
up
schemed
and plan it together, right? But yeah, I mean,
as
this
far
is
as you know.
Yeah. As far as I know, I can neither confirm nor deny having been at that meeting. But the idea that it's somehow a strike against something when some of the most prominent people on the left and some of the most prominent people on the right, broadly speaking, both think it's a good idea, like. I am skeptical of bipartisan legislation by and large. Like, I think there is often good reasons to fear bipartisanship. But in this case, like, I just think it's super weird to be like because it isn't bipartisan in the classic sense of like Congress horse traded its way to some garbage that costs a lot of money and like gives benefits to both sides that are irrelevant to the bill itself. This is genuinely a sort of, you know, a strain of American conservatism and a strain of American leftist progressivism working together for something that is designed to help the least well off in our society. Like, if we're going to impute sinister motives to that, then like, OK, I give up. But I think, you know, Tom Cotton aside and Tom Cotton, Mitch McConnell axis aside.
Cocaine Mitch.
I do think.
Would you say it's an axis of evil?
I would not say that. I think it's an axis of misguided, as always. But
if only you had been president.
Axis of misguided is really not catchy. Yeah. But I do think that this is a remarkable change from where we were even 5 years ago. And even if it doesn't pass this time, I also do not buy the apocalyptic like it's now or never. Like I actually think this is an emerging consensus, similar to drug legalization, similar to gay marriage. I think we'll have some more
not
chances
just similar
to get
to,
this right.
I think it is quite related to drug legalization. And while it may not pass here in the next couple of months, I think it's going to pass in the next couple of years. And I think it's going to be a lead in.
And it's happening on the state level already.
To national deregulation of marijuana.
Let's try to instill a fierce sense of urgency in this, though. And I think, you know, I agree with everything that's been said. But this is the time we spend a lot of time talking about the four or five or maybe six, and it's more like three libertarian leaning Republicans in Congress, and then there's a couple of Democrats who are so libertarian leaning on certain issues. These guys, Rand Paul, Thomas Massie, Justin Amash, a few others, Jared Polis before he becomes governor, they've got to get out there and they have to throw a shit fit in their leadership. I mean, it's about time. And I recognize these guys suffer under overwhelming odds and all of that, but like, throw a fit and get this through, because there is a consensus. It's the right thing to do. And I agree, it's going to happen. But this is kind of like, it matters a lot what day a war ends on, because right up until that day, and maybe even for a couple of days after, people are going to be wounded or killed. And this has gone on long enough. The idea of rolling back the carceral state is something that is so long overdue and so pure. Anything that we can do as quickly as possible is to the benefit. So I agree with everything. And I'm just saying, like, get the libertarian leaning Congress people with a conscience, social conservatives who recognize what hath wrought, been wrought by bipartisan sentencing things that were passed by Democrats and Republicans 20, 25 years ago. It has to stop. Liberals, get on your high horse for once and do the right thing.
I'm actually not sure that I am the farthest thing in the world from a legislative strategist, but I'm not sure that this is the fit throwing moment. I think this is the, everybody keep your cool moment. I think this is the hey, we're all reasonable here, buddy buddy moment. Maybe that's just my natural tendency in things in life. It absolutely is, but I think we're past the hysterics for attention part. Like, we're now in the get it done part.
Rand Paul has eaten a lot of shit in order to buddy up with Mitch McConnell. No, he has. And he's done it he hasn't done it because he agrees with him. But, and he does get some compromises. Mitch McConnell is now in favor of industrial hemp and all of that. This is the time where he should go and throw up on Mitch McConnell's desk and say, like, I've eaten a lot of shit and I put up with a lot of crap, in order to be a team player, give my side
one. The extent to which you're theme of this podcast is just like,
it's really kind of digestational. Really,
it's really troubling.
Sorry.
Before we're going to need to go back to that metaphorical bidet by the time this is over.
Right. Well, that would be the appropriate kicker for the podcast. Will be Nick recommending a good brand of bidet.
Nick, before we leave the topic, doesn't the fact that criminal justice reform persevered and kept advancing even in the face of a law and order president, the Jeff Sessions attorney general, doesn't it ratify a kind of a bottom-up sense that was talked about a lot in the 2011 book of some note?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think, Matt, for the Declaration of Independence, we got many things wrong in that book, chief among them the timing. But what we were talking about there was hyperpolarization and a loss of affiliation, of partisan affiliation. That has proceeded apace, and we are starting to see what happens next. And a lot of weird good things are opening up, including something like criminal justice reform and, actual implementation of legal marijuana.
So we have arrived at the end of podcast. What cultural products are you consuming out there? I want to start with Peter Suderman to tell us.
I watched the movie Widows. It's a heist thriller by Steve McQueen in which the widows of a bunch of sort of professional robbers end up pursuing the heist that was left behind after this gang of professional thieves dies. And it is a fantastic heist thriller. It is also one of the most amazingly cynical movies about every political and social institution I've ever seen in a completely delightful way. So one of the main B plot is about an election for alderman in Chicago. And one of the it pits, on the one hand, a drug dealer who has decided that being an alderman and having his hands in all of the money that an alderman can get his hands into is a much better scam for robbing the community than dealing drugs, against a kind of white working class sort of family that has passed on the alderman That is basically passing on the alderman position from father to son, and of course already has all of that money, which then comes into play in the heist aspect. The leader of the lady heist gang is a former teacher's lobbyist who, of course, puts her skills.
Do we need to interview the screenwriter for this?
The screenwriter is Gillian Flynn, the writer of Gone Girl. Mm. She co-wrote it with director Steve McQueen, not that one. The guy who also directed 12 Years a Slave and a couple of other films. And it's just fantastic. It works on every level. The kind of the political commentary is imagine The Wire, except much more biting. The thriller aspects are great. I mean, some of the twists and turns are really nicely structured. The action scenes are just super crisp. The characters are really well drawn. The acting's all great. It's just a fantastic movie. One of my favorite films of the year. And I highly recommend it to anyone who thinks Chicago politics are bullshit and likes action movies.
Holy cow, Nick, you can't possibly hope to top that, so
well,
try.
Well, I have one quick follow-up question. Peter, have we reached the point in cinema yet where Nazi gold is going to be replaced by Soros gold in heist movies?
I don't think I understand that question.
Well, instead of people always trying to find a cache of Nazi gold, have we reached the point now where they'll be looking for Soros gold?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Well, thank you. I have been watching the Australian TV show that's been on for, I don't know, like 5 years or more, Rake, which is about it's available on Netflix as well as I think Amazon streaming, both for free, but it's about a kind of ne'er-do-well barrister who has a commitment not to justice, but to the law, and then has an incredibly screwed up personal and professional life. And it is very funny. It's a kind of more high-minded version of Californication, the old David Duchovny show, and a wide variety of other things. I find it immensely enjoyable. The first plot, and this is particular for reasons, the first episode of the first season is about a government advisor, an economist who is a big fan of Milton Friedman, whose austerity budget has just been, or his plans for the budget have just been adopted by the government, and then he's revealed to be a cannibal. And the main character, Rake, has to defend him in court from charges of cannibalism and murder.
All right, Catherine, you have to top Milton Friedman cannibalism.
I'm not going to, but I actually have two quick recommendations. One is, as I referenced at the top of the podcast, we just put online a piece of short fiction that we published in the 50th anniversary magazine. It's by Cory Doctorow, one of my faves. And I don't want to give too much away, but I will say it's about the future of intellectual property and also about dishwashers. And its title, which is Soul and Despotic Dominion, is a reference to the way that the great jurist William Blackstone described the right to property, the sole and despotic dominion which one man claims and exercises over the external things of the world. So it's pretty good. It's very short. You should read it. There's a picture of a broken plate as the image. Go check it out at reason.com. But the other thing I want to flag real quick is a Twitter discourse that is happening right now, which is about aposematic hair. There's a whole conversation on Twitter happening right now about whether women who have non-natural hair colors are the same as poisonous tree frogs, and I can't recommend it highly enough.
Wow.
Wait, so what's the answer?
Is there a hashtag for that? Is that under Jonathan Franzen Sucks hashtag?
Yeah, that you can find it there, yes. The alpha and the omega of this very... I will give you the summary, which is, some dudes from the manosphere basically tweeting like, oh, you know, these ladies with purple hair, they're all crazy. You should really stay away from them. They're like the poisonous tree frogs. And then a bunch of women tweeting back like, yeah, so those bright colors are supposed to discourage predators. So if it's warning you off, I guess that shit worked.
I only saw a little bit of the Shoshana Weissman contribution.
Yes, she is part of this discourse.
She's right in the middle of it, so that can only be good. I will close this by recommending not a, necessarily a piece of art, but a piece of journalism by Jamie Kirchick. It's novella length, for God's sake. It's about, I think it's the headline is the truth about George Soros, and it's in Tablet magazine, but it's actually a really, really, really deep dive into a complicated character and the reactions to him, drawing an important distinction between the work, the important and largely good, although sometimes not very effective and sometimes controversial work that Open Society Foundations have done in Europe, former communist Europe in particular, of which Kirchick has some pretty good intimate knowledge about, but a distinction between that and the real kind of crude us versus them participation in American politics that he has done and saying and showing how those two projects are inherently at tension and actually kind of threatening one another in interesting ways, and how in that process, the things that were interesting about Soros' own kind of sense of intellect have completely eroded and degraded in ways that are kind of awful. It's a Jamie Kirchick piece, which means you will disagree with large chunks of it. One of the interesting exercises about it is that he goes in and kind of documents the lengths to which Soros insisted on comparing George W. Bush administration to Nazis over and over and over again from 2003 to 2008, kind of degradation of the discourse that right now he and his allies are complaining about in terms of it being pointed towards him. It's a good piece for people who want to understand the complicated and important figure. And that's all the complications and Jamie Kirchick recommendations. God help me. Just kidding, Jamie. Hi, what's up? We have time for here at the Reason Editors Roundtable podcast. Thank you for listening. Subscribe to us again. If you've done it once, just do another one for your mom on iTunes.
It's not how it works.
You actually can go to your mom's house and just subscribe her to a bunch of podcasts.
My mom's dead, Peter.
Goodbye.
Oh, happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Yep.